Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. You know, every 15 seconds, a woman is beaten by her husband or boyfriend. This is in the United States. One out of every four men will use violence against a partner at some time in their relationship. And children are present during 80% of the assaults against their mothers. Michael Paymar, for those of you listening who are clinicians, is probably part of your almost daily language, as he and the late Ellen Pence were two of the co-founders of the Duluth Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, which in many ways has been the gold standard in terms of providing services in the domestic violence arena. Michael Paymar wears many hats. He is an author, a film producer, a trainer, and has spent 18 years as an elected member of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Michael is also the author of Violent No More, Helping Men End Domestic Abuse. Michael Paymar, thank you so much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Thank you very much for having me, Pamela.
Now, Michael, you're a man, and you do a lot of work in working with men who have found themselves engaged in violent behaviors. Why? Why is this a calling for you? It seems like it is.
Oh, well, you know, it was sort of an interesting experience in my life about three decades ago. I wasn't intending on having this as my career path. I was actually going to be a teacher, and I was a member of the Duluth City Council, and Duluth is a small, relatively small city in Minnesota. And I met a woman named Ellen Pence who was just organizing the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. And she was looking for some men who she thought would be helpful working with other men who were abusive in their intimate relationships. And I got to know her, and I was listening to her vision, her mission, her challenge to our community about doing something about domestic abuse. And I got in at the very beginning stages when the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project was first starting. And I realized that a lot of the men that I was seeing who were getting arrested under the new mandatory arrest law were not that different from myself. We had all grown up in a very sexist culture. The society had given us messages as boys and as men about what it means to be a man and what we want a woman in our lives for. And so we were all socialized in much the same way. And I realized at that very early stage that I could be helpful in trying to get men to think about their beliefs and attitudes that lead them to believe that using violence against an intimate partner is okay. And the journey started, and it hasn't changed since.
Well, and it's certainly been an important one. You've absolutely been part of important pieces of information and guidance for the clinical as well as the non-clinical community. Let's start with a definition of violence. Your book is entitled Violent No More. Are we talking about physical violence? If you hit somebody, is that violent? And if you don't hit somebody, are you not violent?
Well, when I'm talking about domestic violence, and specifically what the book is the book is written to men who, what I would say, are battering their intimate partners. And when we talk about battering, this isn't a shove, or this isn't like screaming at somebody in an argument. When I'm talking about battering, some people are familiar, especially clinicians out there who do this work, with the power and control wheel. Mm-hmm. And this wheel was developed in Duluth with the help of battered women who were trying to explain what their lives were like living with a man who abused them. And in the power and control wheel has on the outside of the rim sexual violence and domestic violence. That holds the wheel together. And there's a circle inside the wheel that says power and control. Mm-hmm. And those two words are really the intent behind using physical violence, to stop someone from saying something, to stop someone from doing something. So that's the intent behind the behavior. And then inside the wheel, you'll see, if you were looking at the power and control wheel now, you'd see words like emotional abuse, coercion, threatening behavior, using money, using the children. And so these are what we would call abusive tactics that a batterer can use. And so they don't necessarily have to use physical violence to get their way. They can resort to other tactics systematically to control their intimate partner. So it's really a constellation of different kinds of abusive behavior that together can be very destructive, and often trap battered women in this place where she feels like she can't escape because she's intimidated by her partner. She fears she'll lose her children. She may believe that she's at fault for the violence happening. And so it's this constellation of behaviors that a batterer uses to dominate. And that's what we try to tell men who we come in contact with, usually through the courts, who are ordering them, is that, yes, we want you to give up your physical violence. You have to do that. It's a crime. You're hurting people. But you also have to give up the other behaviors if you really want to have an equal, respectful, intimate relationship with your partner, and if you want to model good behavior for your children. So it's a big challenge for men who have used these kinds of tactics, but we have seen tremendous success stories, and that's what the book and the workbook is for, is to help men understand the roots of the physical violence, the roots of their battering, and then give them a track to change.
Just for folks listening to know, the violence and nonviolence wheels are readily available on the internet for anyone who wants to take a look at them. The idea, and I just want to get this out here up front, because you know that there is someone listening who is saying, often it's a man, who's saying, well, men get abused too. Why should I listen to this guy? He's just picking on men, and women are the bad guys as well. What do you say to that person?
Well, I would say it's a very, that, you know, there's a lot of, it's not just men who think that. There is certainly controversy about this issue in the domestic violence field, in the psychology field. It's been going on since, I would say, the mid-70s, when what we called the battered women's movement came mm-hmm. out of the women's movement and really started to address the issue of gender violence. And it's not that women don't use violence. They do in intimate relationships. You'll see women slap their partners, use violence in self-defense. Sometimes they initiate the violence, but it is, and I would never condone that kind of behavior. It's wrong. It's dangerous, and more dangerous usually to the woman who's using it, because she's liable to get beat up in a far more severe way. But mm-hmm. what I was just describing to you about battering, this systematic use of other abusive behaviors to dominate and control their partner, women who use violence against their male spouse typically does not have that kind of intention. A woman doesn't have that intention. She's not trying to dominate and suppress her male partner.
I see.
She may be using violence because she's angry, under the influence of alcohol or drugs. There might be lots of reasons why she's using violence or fighting back, but it's not the same as male violence when the intention is to control the other person. Most men who are abused by their female partner can get out of their relationship. Mm. I mean, they can leave. I'm out the door, and they're rarely stalked like women are by their female partner. So they can get out of an abusive relationship. But if you do and look at the research on women who are victims of domestic violence, their situation is much more dire. They're getting out of an abusive relationship is dangerous. We know that a lot of female victims become homicide victims when they try to leave an abusive relationship. So it's a different dynamic. It's a different intent, and the results are quite different. So that's the way I would respond either to a man or a woman who might raise that question, or to a clinician who may wonder why we're not talking in a more gender neutral term.
Okay. You address the men who are reading your book as being courageous. Why courageous?
Well, I think that it takes courage to change. You know, when you think about the kinds of messages that boys and men get about what it means to be a man, from a very young age, we're taught to control our emotions, not to cry, to when we're up against someone at school who might be a bully, we're supposed to fight him back. You know, we're supposed to win, we're supposed to dominate, we're supposed to be in control. And you know, those kinds of messages have a deep and profound impact on boys and on into adolescence. And then when men get into a relationship with an intimate partner. And so if your belief system has been formulated by these cultural messages, to then say, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm not only going to stop using physical violence, but I want to be supportive. I want to trust. I want to have a loving relationship with my intimate partner. It takes a lot of courage to, A, seek help, because most men who batter need that kind of help.
Okay.
You know, I'd like to believe just reading my book alone would do the trick, but I, if you've read my book, Pamela, you know that I say, in addition to the book, you really should go to a domestic abuse group or see a counselor and work with a professional to try to get at the roots of the violence. So it takes a fair amount of commitment to say, just like someone who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, that I need help, I'm reaching out, and I'm going to get it because I want to change. And that's why I think that men who take these first steps are quite courageous, because they're not going to necessarily get support from, you know, their friends, maybe not even their family members. But it's what I'm trying to say to men is that it doesn't have to be a lonely journey. There's a lot of men out there that that know that their abuse and their violence is causing enormous pain, not only to their partners but to their children, and that ultimately they're probably going to lose their relationship if they don't do something about it.
Michael, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, you make a point early on in your book that I'd like to explore in more detail, when you say that most men who hit once will hit again. So, folks, this is Pamela Brewer. I am having a conversation with Michael Paymar, who is the author of Violent No More. And by the way, folks, this is the third edition, revised. Violent No More, Helping Men End Domestic Abuse. We'll be right back with more from Michael Paymar. Michael, you've made the comment, most men who hit once will hit again. That sounds a little scary.
Mm-hmm.
What are your...
Go ahead.
Can you say more about that? Is it the case that if he hits once, he's going to continue hitting, there's no solution, and what, you should go or learn to live with it? Or what are you saying when you say if he hits once, he'll hit again?
Well, Pamela, I say that not only to men but also to women out there who are victimized, because I really want women to know who are living with a violent intimate partner that if he hits you once, he'll do it again. It's not just, I didn't make that up. The research clearly demonstrates that. And, you know, so many women that I worked on when I was doing direct service with men who batter, I would talk to these female victims, and they so wanted to believe that their partners would change.
Yes.
And they wanted to salvage their relationship. They took responsibility wrongly for the violent behavior, thinking that it was their fault. They believed in their marriage. And so when the first violent incident happens, most women who have been abused would tell me that they thought it was an aberration. In other words, you know, this isn't the man that I married. This isn't my husband. This isn't my boyfriend. I don't know where this came from. So there's a sort of a state of confusion about what happened. And a lot of times during the first violent incident, a man will be apologetic, will use an excuse like, I was drunk or I was angry, and, you know, it'll never happen again. And she wants to believe him. So she does forgive him. But it will happen again. And I say it will happen again, this is because violence is incredibly powerful and it works. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. It works. So if I'm an abuser and I'm in an argument with my partner and she's saying things to me that I don't want to hear, if she's threatening me, we're in the midst of this big fight, if I slap her, if I punch her, if I grab her by the hair and drag her around the living room, you know, what is going to be the result? She's going to stop arguing with me.
Right.
I'm going to win. Nine times out of ten, a man is going to win that physical fight. Now, he may feel bad about it, you know, that he shouldn't have gotten to that level, but it sends a very clear message to him that it is effective, that it works. It stops an argument. It punishes someone for something that they have done. And so he may be on his best behavior for a short period of time, but when the argument starts again or when she does something that upsets him again, he's going to use physical violence. And the research also is very clear that the violence tends to escalate in severity.
Mm-hmm.
So she may forgive, come back to him, forgive, come back to him. And some researchers have found that this could happen 6, 7, 8 times before a battered woman will get the courage and the strength and the resources necessary to get out of an abusive relationship. So that's my message to women who are abused, but it's also my message to men that if you don't get help, if you don't get intervention, you'll keep using physical violence again, and the results of that are going to be you're going to lose your relationship or you're going to go to jail. So that, you know, that's kind of a clear, concise message about domestic violence. It's unacceptable, and you need to do something about it right away when it starts, both men and women.
Speaking of jail, there are several laws on the books. I mean, there was a time when it was not considered a crime to be physically abusive toward your spouse. Now the world is changing. Do you believe that the laws that are on the books are helpful? Are they sufficient? Would you like to see something more, something different?
Well, that's a great question, Pamela, because I when I started doing this work in Duluth at the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, that's exactly what my colleague and the founder of the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, Ellen Pence, really was talking about. You know, I'm sort of dating myself here, but that was back in 1980, and there wasn't a police department in this country that would make an arrest when there was a domestic assault unless they actually visually observed the assault taking place. That's where things were at 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now every state in the country has a law that gives law enforcement officers the authority to make a warrantless arrest if they have probable cause to believe that an assault occurred. So that gives the state, you know, clear power to make an arrest. Now the question is do they? You know, it varies from state to state, from county to county, and city to city. It's important that law enforcement agencies take these crimes seriously because they're dangerous, they're deadly. Mm-hmm. We see the statistics every day. So I think that the laws have helped on the criminal side. I think it gives, there was a man that I interviewed for the book, and he was, he was one of the first men who was arrested under the mandatory arrest law in Duluth. And okay. He told me, and he had beat up his wife several times, and the police were called. They never made an arrest because he was always very calm, always cooperative when the police came. And his wife was always angry and would scream at the police and scream at him. And, you know, he'd say to the officers, "It's not me. Look at her. She's the crazy one here." Gotcha. And they'd go and talk to her and tell her to behave. And he'd just, you know, smile. He never got arrested until that law was implemented. So I think it gives men who batter a very clear message that their violence is criminal. And if they get arrested and have to go through the court system, it sends an additional message. And hopefully offenders get sent to programs where they can learn how to change their behavior. So on the criminal side, that's very important. On the civil side, getting a civil order for protection has been very helpful to victims to go to the court and say that I need some separation from my partner until he stops using physical violence. So the laws have been helpful, but they're not enough. And it really takes that individual man being willing to say, "I'm not going to do this again." And that's where they need tools. That's where they need help. That's where they need support from their family, from their friends, from their community, from their churches. And when I say support, I mean support for their change process. It's critical.
Now, you've mentioned certainly being arrested and going to jail. And certainly there are some folks who are afraid to report the violence. And once it is reported, then the abuser may use any number of tactics to try to get, we'll say, her to drop the charges. Is that possible? Do the laws speak to that likelihood?
Now, that's another great question, Pamela. You're hitting all the right buttons here about the dynamics of domestic abuse cases, because that frequently happens. I have to say there's been progress in a lot of jurisdictions around the country where if a victim does not want to participate, if you will, or cooperate with the city or county prosecutor, there are a lot of prosecutors who will simply dismiss the charges because it's very difficult to gain a conviction without having your witness, which is the victim, testify. And, you know, it's obvious that many victims don't want to testify. First of all, it often takes a significant amount of time for the case to get to trial. So you may have the offender during that time period saying to his wife or his girlfriend, "Look, it'll never happen again, but if you go through with this, we're done." You know, so he may make that threat, or he may make the threat, "If you go through with this, I'm going to get custody of the children and you'll never see them again." He may threaten to harm her. So there's a lot of there's a lot of pressure on her to drop the charges or to not participate in the prosecution. Now, most prosecutors won't simply drop the charges, but if she's not going to be a willing witness, it makes it very difficult to gain a conviction. Some prosecutors have allowed in different kinds of evidence, police reports, other witnesses, past history of violence, et cetera, et cetera. So they still may be able to gain convictions even without having the victim testify. So the prosecutors have gotten smarter in some districts and understand the dynamics of domestic abuse and have been able to get around this. But it still is a big problem when you have these kinds of forces that are really putting pressure on the victim not to testify.
Absolutely. You talk in your book to several different men, and one of them, I think it was perhaps the first story, was Andy's story. And he spent much of his time when he was battering his wife feeling completely justified in battering his wife. How was he able to change his view?
Yeah, I mean, that happens, I think, with the majority of men that come into our program. About 90% of the men who are come into our program are court-ordered by the criminal or civil court. So they have to go, otherwise they're going to go to jail. So they come in typically with, they're angry, number one, that they got caught. Number two, they're angry that they're being forced into this treatment program that they don't feel is right. They come in blaming their wives and girlfriends for what happened. Mm-hmm. This is at the very core. I mean, whether they blame them, what we hear constantly from men is, if she wouldn't have said this, if she wouldn't have provoked me, if she wouldn't have done that, if she would have come home on time, if she would have taken care of the kids better, I wouldn't have had to. I mean, every possible rationalization that you can think of or justification that we might think of, he uses to rationalize his use of violence. I had no other choice. If you were in my situation, you would do the same thing. This is what men who come into our programs typically say. So they're angry, they blame, they deny, they minimize. They'll say, oh, it wasn't really that bad. The police came and she overreacted, or they overreacted, and here I am, now I have to go to this six-month program. So that's sort of the dynamic when men come into these programs. And the man, Andy, that you were talking about, he fit that to a T. He totally blamed his partner. He said that she was as violent as he was, even though he was twice as big as she was, mm-hmm. And always took the brunt of it when she would fight back. But she did fight back. But he was just so convinced that it was her fault that he was ordered into this program. And he was belligerent. He was angry at us. He wouldn't participate. And then something started to shift for him towards the end of the program. He started to listen to, wasn't me so much, it was the other men in the program who started to say, you know, maybe there's some validity to what's being said here about, you know, domestic abuse. Maybe there's some validity in that I had other options besides using physical violence because I was angry at her. Maybe there's some validity that what I saw my dad doing to my mom had an impact on me growing up. So they start to have this dialogue together in the group about the culture, about their families, about their own beliefs about men and women, about this sense of superiority that men have with women, the sense of entitlement that I get to call the shots in the relationship. And mm-hmm. and you start to see some of the resistance break down. So some of the men who are just coming into the program who are like Andy was when he first came in, they start to get challenged, if you will, by the other men who have now gone through this process. And they have to, for men to be successful, they have to sort of step back and take it in and say, is this me? And is this who I want to be? And that's what happened to Andy. And he finally said, you know, all these guys, they're sort of a collective part of who I am, and I want to change. And he went through an incredible change process. He realized he had a severe alcohol problem, and he got treatment. He ended up getting divorced from his wife, but he really felt that he wanted to be different in his next intimate relationship, and he went and got therapy because he had observed some horrible things that his father had done to his mother. But that's what goes back to the word courage. You know, he had the courage to say, "I need help." He got it. He changed, and then he ended up actually working with Men Who Batter.
Wow.
Got his therapy license, and so he was an incredible success story.
It sounds like an incredible success story, Michael. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. In your book, Violent No More, about various approaches, various concepts that you work with men on. And one of them is understanding and accepting women's anger, which, you know, is so complicated, I think, for men and women, the concept of women actually being angry. How do you approach that with your clients, and how do they respond?
Well, you know, this, Pamela, I guess it's sort of the heart of it for a lot of men is that they see women's anger as being a threat to their sense of control and authority in the household. Men, I think, have a difficult time sharing and talking about their emotions, what they're really feeling. And so the male realm typically is that the only emotion that they do share is anger. And so when that anger is met by anger, it becomes an incredible threat to him. And that's when he'll resort to using physical violence when he feels like he is being challenged, his authority is being challenged. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do in our groups, one of the things we say is that women get angry. They're going to get angry. They're going to yell back at you. And you have to figure out ways that you can communicate with your partner in a way that doesn't escalate that kind of behavior. So, I think that it's important for Men Who Batter to understand that why, even if they make the commitment and say, I'll never hit you again, I'm going to counseling, I'm dealing with my problems, that she's not going to trust you. Mm. You're going to have to prove to her, not just, this week, not just this month, but ongoing, that you have changed your behavior. So she's not going to trust you. She may test you. She may push you. And you're going to see that as provocative. And you can either go down that lane that you went before, or you can find a different way of interacting with her. And sometimes, we talk about some of the various techniques that are used, but sometimes a man who batters needs to just get away from the situation for a while You know, we call that taking a time out in the anger management kind of field. But some of these things can be very helpful just to cool down, to think about what they're feeling, what they're thinking, and to approach a contentious issue with their intimate partner in a different manner. They just need to get away from a situation. So, but, you know, I think a lot of men have trouble dealing with women who get angry. Mm-hmm. And it's a powerful dynamic. And a lot of the men will share stories about why that is so powerful for them and how they deal with it. So it's one of the issues that men who batter just have to deal with.
Well, one of the tools that you just talked about was taking a time out. And, you know, a lot of people, taking a time out is sort of part of our language. But typically we're talking about that little 4-year-old, 5-year-old kid who's having a temper tantrum. So when you talk about taking a time out, I know there is at least a few people saying, timeouts? Really? I'm a grown up. Does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, it works only in two ways. What we're talking about with men who batter, of course, is that you're in the middle of a conflict with your wife or your girlfriend, and invariably that's going to happen in relationship. The healthiest relationships, you're going to have conflict. But, you know, if a man has used physical violence in the past and he senses that he's going to be violent, I'm not talking about just running out of the house every time you get mad. That's inappropriate. And some men do that, and we think that's contrary to what the intent of the timeout is. But if you actually feel like you're getting to the point where you're going to strike your partner or you're going to beat her up, then the best thing that you could do is to leave and to tell her that you're leaving temporarily. Tell her when you're going to come back. We tend to tell men to walk somewhere, to sort of use a calming techniques, and just to get rid of that rage, get rid of that intense anger before you go back in the household. And so a lot of battered women have told me that just that one action made an incredible difference, because their husbands came back. Typically, if they followed the rules, they came back and they were less intense, less angry. So, the concept, I suppose, is the same, in that you're separating yourself from a conflict. But for adults, it can be very important in terms of stopping an incident that may end up becoming violent. But the men who use these techniques, they have to follow the rules. You can't just use it to avoid conflict. And I just want to say one more thing about this whole timeout anger management approach, Pamela, because if you saw in my book, I'm sort of critical of anger management groups. I don't think that they will not work, in my view. Anger management is very, very popular around the country. The courts oftentimes will send offenders to anger management groups, but I have found that they are ineffective. We used to use them, but they're ineffective if you don't change the beliefs and the attitudes of that man about himself as a man, about what he wants a woman in his life for, his sense of entitlement and superiority, because taking a time out is going to be ineffective if he still believes that he should have power and domination over her. So there's sort of a dual track here, but it's critical that men look very deeply at their beliefs and their attitudes, because the timeout will just end up being a tool that gets used against battered women, and I don't think it helps men very much either. So it's a tool, but without the whole package, in my view, it's not going to be very effective.
So from your perspective, and you're right, courts are routinely sentencing people, if you will, to anger management programs. And that's what it feels like to the person who's gotten that directive. What would be better? What would be more useful than an anger management program?
Okay, I think that's hitting it right on. I mean, I there was a clinicians who might be listening to this program probably will remember what was called the cycle of violence theory. Very common, taught in a lot of a lot of colleges and universities. And the cycle of violence, just real quickly, has to do with this idea, this concept that a man who batters has this anxiety and stress level that's building and building and building, and that he's getting all of these different cues, some emotional cues, he might get some physiological cues like tightness in the stomach, his fist might clench up, he's emotionally getting angry, and he builds and he builds and he builds until he finally uses physical violence. And then the theory goes that after that violence that he's apologetic, he's contrite, he tells his partner it never happened again, and then she believes him, and then the cycle starts all over. Well, that cycle of violence has also permeated the whole notion of anger management treatment, that if we can just teach men to recognize when they're starting to get abusive and extricate themselves from their situation, take that time out or whatever, that they won't use physical violence. But I would bring it back to, as long as that man believes that he should be in mm-hmm. control in that relationship, it doesn't matter.
Gotcha.
Whether he recognizes those cues or not, mm-hmm. if he wants to exert his power, he will, because he knows he can. He knows it works, and he will use physical violence. So we tend to support a more cognitive behavioral therapy that helps men think more clearly about their beliefs and attitudes about women.
Okay.
That's really what it comes down to. If you want a true, intimate, equal, respectful relationship with a partner, you can't use physical violence, you can't be abusive. It works, it gets you what you want, but in the long run, it's very self-defeating, and you're going to end up losing your relationship. So it's that kind of understanding that happens in a cognitive behavioral treatment program that we think is most effective.
So in the long run, the violence that in the short run may get you what you want in the short run really doesn't get you what you want at all and moves you further away from it.
That's exactly right. And that is probably the biggest sort of light bulb, aha moment that the men in group finally recognize, because unfortunately a lot of the men who are in our program, they've used physical violence a lot. Mm-hmm. People think you use physical violence one time, you get arrested. Well, typically, there's a long history of physical violence and abusive behavior. So these guys come into the program, and even the ones who want to give it a try and start to come to terms with their violence, a lot of times the relationship has been so soured and so chilled and devastated by the violence that it's really hard to for a couple to trust and to come back together again and work through it. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of work, and sometimes marriage counseling after the domestic abuse work is been completed.
Gotcha.
But so in the short run, yeah, you stop the argument, you shut her up, all right.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, you might end up losing the very person that you said you loved.
Right. Michael, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I would like to talk a little bit about the domestic abuse problems in the military. We hear about it more and more, not nearly enough, but you certainly do address it in your book. So, folks, when we come back, domestic abuse in the military. You are listening to Men's Monday on Mind Talk, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Michael, there was certainly a time when everything that the military did, according to the military, was really just fine. But more and more, there is an awareness of the stressors that come along with being in the military. There are programs specifically for women. I don't know about for men, though. So that's a question for you. But there are programs specifically for women who have been harmed by their spouses, by their partners in the military. How do you send someone off to war, which is completely violent, and then tell them to come back home and be nonviolent?
No, that's a good question. The current wars and over the last decade, Iraq and Afghanistan are quite different than past wars that the United States has been involved in. I think back to, you know, the Vietnam War, of course, when you had the draft, and now you have a different kind of professionalized armed services where you have a lot of primarily young men, but a lot of young women too who are joining the armed forces. You know, you used to have this term called, shell shocked back in World War II. Mm-hmm. Now we know more about the impact of war on young service men and women. And the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury from explosive devices that have happened in Iraq and Afghanistan have been just devastating. And so you're seeing a lot of these young men coming home with some significant psychological problems. And the VA and frankly, our country is just starting to take a look at how we've neglected service personnel and veterans over the years. And so these young men and women are coming back with multiple problems, sometimes having co-occurring conditions.
Yes.
But one thing that the VA and the armed services has not done is they have not really screened for intimate partner violence or domestic violence. And so that's sort of the struggle that the field is having now, is that you're seeing these young men come back and they're quite troubled and they get involved with the criminal justice system. They may have difficulty reintegrating with their families, and then there's domestic abuse and they get arrested. And so the big question is, you know, what came first? Were you already a domestic abuser before you left for Iraq and Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
Or did something in that war change who you were as a man that led to your criminal or domestic abuse when you returned to the United States? And that's sort of the dilemma now, as we're starting to put more energy and resources into working with service personnel and veterans. But it's a complicated issue.
Yes.
So you may have a man coming back from Afghanistan who is a domestic abuser, but may also have a substance abuse problem, severe depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder. And what we're saying is that we need to do a better job of screening for all of the above and making treatment programs available. But I have to say the VA and our country has been slow to act, not just on the domestic violence front, but also on the large a number of suicides and
yes.
sexual assaults that happen in the armed services. And we've seen congressional hearings recently about what female members of the armed services have had to deal with. So it's a complicated situation for the military right now, but I'm glad that it's finally getting addressed, at least at the basic levels.
You know, one of the pieces that has come up in conversations that I've had with military spouses is that there's a concern, military spouses, military personnel in general, there's a concern that if they report the abuse to the commanding officer, that the commanding officer may ignore it, which is less likely to happen perhaps today than yesterday, but could certainly ignore it, or could somehow penalize the alleged abuser, which then comes back and penalizes, particularly if it's a spouse, but certainly if it's a coworker as well. So how do we think about that sort of maze, if you will?
Well, is really going to have to take place is the military has to change, quite frankly, and they have been slow to change. You've seen the congressional hearings in Washington over the numbers of young women who have been sexually assaulted in the armed services, and you know, the military has been slow to act on the domestic violence front as well as the sexual violence front. And you're quite right. I mean, a victim whose partner is in the military will be quite fearful of reporting to the commanding officer or calling the police for that matter if mm-hmm. she's beaten up by her husband or boyfriend, because what does that mean? You cannot then possess a firearm, which of course is a critical piece of material for fighting in war. So you're likely to be discharged from the armed services. So that means it's a career breaker. So you have that dynamic going on with victims of domestic violence as well as victims of sexual assault, that if I report this, A, I won't be believed. Right. B, my sexual life may be trampled over and exposed, or that I will be drummed out of the military. So you have a situation where it's very difficult for victims to come forward, and then you have the command that, you know, their number one mission is to you know, win the war. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, and to having a highly trained personnel under their command. And so, you know, the family issues and social issues are things that have been slow to deal for the command to deal with. And but it has to change. I mean, it's a public embarrassment to the military, and I think that they will if they get enough pressure from Congress and enough, you know, negative publicity, which they certainly have gotten. But it's you know, it can be very difficult for a victim to just sort of live and adapt in this very abusive situation, because she fears that she's going to destroy her husband's career and by extension their livelihood.
So although there is a significant amount of work to be done, what I'm hearing is that at least that we're beginning, and that's good, but in a lot of ways we're still at the beginning, particularly when it comes to the way the military is dealing with this, although we have made great strides in the community at large. Is that a fair summing up?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it's akin to what happened about 35 years ago when we started to realize that domestic violence wasn't just a problem that couple down the block had that was kept sort of secret. You know, that it was really a massive problem, that 25% of women in our country were being abused by their husbands or boyfriends. So that, you know, it took sort of that public acknowledgement that this is a widespread social problem in our country before institutions decided that they would do anything about it, whether it be the criminal justice system or law enforcement. So it's taken about 35 years just to get to this place where, as a society, we recognize that this behavior is wrong, that it's criminal, that it's dangerous, and it needs to stop. And I think the military is just coming to that conclusion that they have a significant problem in their ranks. And, you know, so what does this come down to? They have to train personnel differently. They have to respond and intervene at appropriate times. There has to be consequences for the behavior. And, you know, I think that that's, the military has been slow to come to that conclusion, but they know that if they want to be effective, they're going to have to make these significant changes, and it may take a push from Congress to make it happen.
You know, I note that the name of the organization of which you are the director is the Education for Critical Thinking, and I would suggest that more critical thinking is exactly what we need to do, certainly in the military, but really in the world at large, particularly around this issue. There's much more we could talk about. We haven't touched on same-sex violence, and we will have to take a look at that in future programs. But for today, Michael Paymar, I can't tell you how delighted I am to have had the opportunity to talk with you and to bring your wisdom to the audience. Folks, Michael Paymar, Executive Director, Education for Critical Thinking, and author of Violent No More, Helping Men End Domestic Abuse. Michael, is there a website or a place that you would like to send folks to gather more information?
Yeah, if people are interested in the book, it's published by Turner Publishing Company. You just go to turnerpublishing.com. Or if you'd like to see our website and see some of the work that we're doing on gender violence prevention, you can go to educationforcriticalthinking.org. My former colleague Ellen Pence and I wrote this film called With Impunity, Men and Gender Violence, and we have a curriculum that's coming out this summer. You know, this issue is more than just domestic violence. It's gender violence, is sexual violence and sex trafficking and violent pornography. And we really think that it's important that men and women start having a discussion about not just how to stop it, but how to prevent it. And that's what our organization's about.
Absolutely. Michael, once you get more materials out in the world and you'd like to come back on Mind Talk to talk about it, by all means, you have a standing invitation.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you very much, Pamela.
All righty, my pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. And remember that you can listen to this program again and any Mind Talk program on demand simply by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a medical or mental health professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26 by 2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. A reminder, for more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And remember, always remember, if it's unacceptable, that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.